Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Solari Report. I'm so excited to be joined by Whitney Webb, who has written and published her two-volume expose. It's really a scholarly treatise on Epstein. It's long-awaited. It's exciting. I had a chance to read it while I was down at Lake Hunstan, and it is an absolute blockbuster. So, Whitney, we're so delighted you could join us on the Solari Report. And I just have to say congratulations for an absolutely momentous accomplishment. I had no idea how you did it.
Thanks. It was hard, actually, because at the same time, you know, I had a baby. Uh-huh. It was COVID fun time.
Yeah.
Fun time. Yeah. For everyone. So, you know, it was definitely a challenge. I agreed to do the book in January 2020, right?
Right.
So that's part of why the book ended up being long awaited. I was supposed to finish it sooner, but, you know.
Well, but there's been excitement. You know, there's this buzz. When is Whitney going to finish this book?
Yeah.
So it's really...
Well, I wrote two books,
yeah.
It turns out, so... Yeah, but I'm happy to have it done. I'm very happy you liked it. I hope everyone likes it. That's my hope.
Well, we're going to describe it because it's very important before you get it. When I got it, I was expecting something very different. And so you really need to understand what it is and to understand it sort of and be prepared because this is really a classic. You know, I say to everybody, if you want to have a history on... I don't care if it's globalization or how politics work or the history of the United States. This is a must-have for your library. You know, every collection has to have this. Anyway, but before we dive in, let's just get a few things out of the way. The book is published by Trine Day. The volume 1, volume 2 is available in a bundle. You can buy them separately or in a bundle. Shipping abroad gets expensive, and we're hoping for an audiobook and PDF over time between now and the end of the year. So the availability will roll out. But right now they can order in a bundle, and it should be able to ship probably by the end of the month or early October. Is that correct?
Yeah. So it won't be, it's not complicated for people that live in the U.S., right? Because the shipping is coming from Trine Day, which is a publisher based in the U.S. The problem is Trine Day shipping internationally. So they're currently working, trying to find distributors in Europe and other places.
Right.
So the shipping cost ends up going down.
Right.
And an ebook and audiobook are already in the works. So
right.
It really shouldn't be that long, hopefully in the next several weeks, you know, by the time, you know, hopefully by the end of next month, it'll be out, but
okay.
You know, things can happen. So
right.
that's the hope. And so it ended up being a 2-volume book. It was originally intended to be 1,
uh-huh.
Got very lengthy. And we'll be talking about why that is, today. The audiobook and the ebook will both have both volumes together. The bundle is the most cost effective way to get both physical copies, which are going to be available first. So for example, if you order the bundle through Trine Day, you will be getting both books. You know, it's one shipment of both books,
right.
The bundle.
And I should mention the name is One Nation Under Blackmail, Volume 1 and Volume 2.
Yeah.
Right.
Sorry. Yeah. The name of the book is One Nation Under Blackmail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway. Okay. So before we dive in, what inspired you to write this book?
Okay, so I originally did a series at Mint Press News, which is where I worked from 2017 until the beginning of 2020, on the Epstein case. And originally I was doing a series on something else, and obviously when Epstein was arrested, it became a major focus of attention for a lot of people. I mean, it sort of dominated media coverage for a time. And I was particularly interested when basically the admission came out that Alex Acosta, who was then Secretary of Labor under Trump, it came out that he had told the Trump transition team that he had signed off on the lenient plea deal for Epstein, the so-called sweetheart deal, during his first arrest because he had been told that Epstein belonged to intelligence and to leave it alone.
Right.
So that's basically confirmation of what people had suspected before, that Epstein had some sort of intelligence connection and was involved, and that the sex trafficking was related to a sexual blackmail operation. So In writing that, I ended up going back into the history too because I sort of stumbled upon how prevalent a lot of this sex blackmail stuff is. At the same time, for example, that the Epstein case broke in terms of his second arrest, there was also focus on the NXIVM sex cult that also involved sex blackmail to a degree and involved the Bronfman family. So, I figured with Epstein, I could figure out the intelligence stuff if I went back in history a bit. And so I stumbled upon the stuff with the Bronfmans and Louis Rosenstiel, who was a sort of a corporate liquor baron, sort of just like the Bronfmans more with Seagram's and their relationship. And it turned out that Louis Rosenstiel was involved in a sexual blackmail operation with the lawyer Roy Cohn, who today is best known as being the mentor to Donald Trump. And because of, the Donald Trump Epstein relationship, it was obviously being talked about at the time. I was like, oh man, I think I've stumbled on something. I might have to get to the bottom of this. So that my effort, to do that was originally this series at Mint Press News, but I mean, it had to be a 4-part series. It was capped at that, and there was no way to get into all the stuff that needed to be explained, really, to flesh out the argument I was trying to make. So, after writing this book, I go back and read that series, and I'm like, oh man, there's like so much left out, because it really did take a 900-page book to explain the intelligence
And
connections of Epstein.
what you show, it's funny because you really do crack through the trance of our Disney world that organized crime is something off here to the side, And you really crack through the trance, and what you see is that America has really risen on the sea of organized crime capital. And Epstein is portrayed as being a sex network. I think of Epstein as being a money laundering network that used sex among other tools. So,
Absolutely. I've said that in several recent interviews, and pretty much every interview since I've finished the book, is that Epstein was a serial financial criminal that dabbled in sex trafficking.
Exactly. Yeah, the sex trafficking was, I like to think of it as a support line. Anyway, so let's dive in. One of the things I adore is how you start the book, because I love the story of how the intelligence agencies and organized crime got deep into it together at the beginning of World War II. So why don't you just quick tell that story? Because it's such a, and you write it beautifully. It's very,
Thanks.
you're already off on the intrigue of organized crime and the intelligence agencies.
Right. So sort of the way the book is written, there's 21 chapters, but each chapter is basically a collection of interrelated short stories. So there's like subsections of each. So the first one I open up with is basically Operation Underworld, as it's remembered today. And this essentially started because there were concerns during World War II that there were German saboteurs on the docks of New York, that were, trying to destroy ships and things like that. And so the Office of Naval Intelligence with the OSS, which is the precursor to the CIA or the Office of Strategic Services, lurking somewhere in the background, decided to make some sort of use dock workers to gather intelligence. And it turned out that the dock workers union was controlled at this point already by organized crime. And so they had to go through this sort of convoluted route, and were led, to talk to a well-known mobster who was in prison at the time, named Charles Luciano, best known as Lucky Luciano. And it was actually the very prosecutor who had put him away, his office that helped set up this deal, and who's Thomas Dewey. And some people may know him as having, having had a failed bid for president in the 50s or so. He was also governor of New York at one point. And he also became formally a business associate of this exact same crime syndicate after Operation Underworld. So that interesting that you have this it's actually sort of a theme in the book of prosecutors who make their career being tough on crime, putting away organized criminals that have already been consigned, their fate has already been sealed by their own supposed allies in organized crime, and then it just becomes a consolidation of territory, and these
Right.
tough on crime prosecutors turn out to be so in bed with organized crime, but they use it as, you know, to rise to the top of politics. A modern example of that, which I don't mention in the book, is Rudolph Giuliani,
Right, of course.
for sure.
Right.
But, you know, this model goes back to Thomas Dewey and a guy named William O'Dwyer, who later became mayor of New York. And so, you know, they make a deal with Luciano, and, you know, eventually Luciano gets freed from prison because of how wonderful Operation Underworld was for these people. But it turns out, you know, the German saboteur concern was not really accurate and was basically seeded by intelligence anyway. So they're basically creating the pretext to ally with organized crime. Like, there wasn't necessarily like a real reason for it at the end of the day, but that was the pretext.
Right.
And essentially you have this alliance take place, and once it happens, you know, it's justified out as, you know, a thing of wartime necessity. The government lied that Operation Underworld happened for several decades until they admitted it had
Well,
indeed
but
happened.
I believe Luciano and the Italian mafia really helped with the landings in Europe and the,
Yeah, well,
yeah.
he was deported. So he was let out of prison, but not in the US, and deported to Italy. And
Right.
so he helped manage stuff over there. And it wasn't just him, like several other deportations took place, mainly of Italian mafiosos who were
Right.
basically sent back and did. Yeah, I mean, it didn't just stay on the New York dock at all.
Right.
It went global very quickly, very
Well,
quickly.
at the end of World War II, it's one of the reasons I love the Godfather series, but at the end of the World War II, you have this existing symbiosis between organized crime and intelligence networks. You had it in Asia, you had it in Latin America, you had it in Europe, especially with this sort of relationship between the ONI and the intelligence agencies and the Italian mafia. But it's that network that then at the end of World War II decides, okay, we're going to open up the US markets for drugs. And the drugs come pouring in.
Yeah. So Luciano was part of something called the National Crime Syndicate, which was basically a decentralized network of different mobs. And basically what had happened is that, you know, if you think about the organized crime makeup of the US in the early 20th century, they're basically all in ethnic enclaves, the
Right.
Italian mafia, the Jewish mob, Irish organized crime, and so on, you
Right.
know. And basically the National Crime Syndicate was a model that was developed where that sort of ethnic siloing went away and they started cooperating. And it was
Right.
basically the Jewish mob and the Italian mafia coming together.
Right.
So, you know, Luciano's main partners in that were people like Mayor Lansky and Bugsy Siegel
Right.
and people in that orbit. You know, there's several names, probably the biggest names you can really think of in, you know, in the legends of organized crime. You know, they were basically part of this because this model enabled them to be really successful. And these guys got really involved with, you know, were involved with drugs in a big way. You have on a global scale,
Right.
really, and intelligence enabled this to basically have state protection once that involvement, once they, you know, that formal alliance took place. But I mean, you have them going to China and you know, opium trade stuff. You have the French connection. It's going through the Middle East. It's going through Europe. I mean, it's basically, you know, they're the drug runners from, you know,
So one of the things
going way back.
you see is you go through volume one. And, you know, I referred to volume one as the begat. So in the New Testament, you have these sections that say, so and so begat so and so begat so and so begat so and so. And what you're doing in volume one is you're developing, teeing up all the networks that lead us to this incredible group that included Epstein of just massive
Yeah.
organized crime. So, anyway.
So basically, what you talk about the Disney World version of like what we're taught, which is a great name for it, is very divorced from reality because it makes a it implies that this acknowledged existence of organized crime just sort of went away and dissolved into the ether on its own at some point in the 50s or 60s, never to return. And so basically, the idea of what you're calling the begats there is showing the idea is to show the continuity between the then and the now.
Right.
Yeah. So it's this crime begat this crime begat this crime, and they never get caught because they get in bed with the
Well,
state,
they have to keep
basically.
growing. But so one of the things I love about Volume One is if you look at the amount of money and stuff, you know, whether it's drugs crossing borders or money being wired globally, what you realize is without institutional support by the banks and the intelligence agencies, this can't happen.
Totally.
Totally. I mean, this is not
Well, the
black teenagers
banks,
in poor neighborhoods running this global business.
the banks are lurking in the back of this the whole time, and that's including the rise of organized crime and also intelligence agencies. Most of the top people in intelligence in the US from a very early stage were like bankers or bankers for Wall Street,
So for
basically.
me, I see the, you know, to me, the CIA is just a bureaucracy of the central banks. But it was really funny while I was reading, I was sort of in the middle of volume one, a voice in my head, I could hear the reader asking, "Well, Whitney, why didn't you include the banks?" And I could hear Whitney thinking, "That would have been 1600 pages."
There's a lot I did have to leave out, because it would have just been too much. Because I'm basically right; it's basically 100-year history, more or less, of this syndicate. So I just tried to pick the main stuff. And the idea is that it's long, but it can be a reference and maybe a starting point for some people to jump into a particular point and then expand a lead further. I obviously don't claim to have detailed everything bad that has ever happened that these people have ever done. I'm just trying to give an overview of how the most important crimes these people have committed, how their network grew over time, and how pretty much a lion's share, I think you can say, of US political scandals involve these people, and that the narrative of those political scandals over the years we have also been lied to about, and were much more extensive and awful than we have been led to believe.
So this is an old, deep, I always say crime that pays is crime that stays, and you really get that feeling as they keep doubling down. So let me bring up a couple of things. One of the things I've looked at a lot is the what happened with the 47 and 49 Act. So coming out of World War II, you saw this incredible deal between what I would describe as the Rockefeller Syndicate and the Jewish mob. And it was that deal that really got the 49 Act created and was instrumental in creating Israel. And it was almost as though that mob said, you know, we want, you guys have a sovereign government to use for air cover. We want a sovereign government too. And so there's no doubt that the sort of the networks that go from America into Israel and back factor into this in a very big way, particularly because it's that's those syndicates in combination that really got a hold of the technology and power shifted a lot of the other mafias since then.
So in the case of Israel, obviously the history of Zionism is a lot more complicated than just the involvement of American organized crime. But American organized crime was involved in it, specifically the Jewish mob was involved in a huge way with the arming of the Haganah, which is the precursor to the IDF, and was at the time a paramilitary group that, you know, by force created the state of Israel and what was then Mandatory Palestine, that was essentially controlled by the British. But the British were involved in it to a huge degree in British intelligence and all of that. And I detail that in the book to the, you know, the best of my ability. It's obviously a much more complicated history,
Well,
to be
you have
sure.
US intelligence and you have British intelligence. Obviously, there are other intelligences, you know, coming in and out, but those two are very, very big players in this history.
So they loom very large in this work. So, you know, I would basically call it the intelligence apparatus of the Anglo-American Empire, I guess you could say. And how Israel fits in with that. But essentially, you know, what happens there is that a Jewish organized crime becomes so instrumental to the arming and you know, the weapons flows within Israel.
Right.
Beginning with the arming of the Haganah, but it continues that really from the off, Israel's national security state, including military intelligence and Mossad and all of that, are tied up with these networks from the very beginning.
Right.
And that's why you see, you know, in things like Iran-Contra, you know, decades later, and in other things, obviously, as well, you see U.S. and Israeli intelligence collaborate in these sorts of activities that involve the same organized crime syndicate, essentially,
right.
Because it goes back to the beginning of the state of Israel.
So we come out of World War II, we have this incredible symbiosis of intelligence and organized crime. It grows and grows and grows. You've got this sea of sort of narcotics trafficking opening to the U.S., but then it explodes into financial fraud. And financial fraud was going on all along, but it really explodes in the 80s. Because in combination, these syndicates get control of the federal credit, and they get control of something even more fantastic. And I don't want to jump ahead because I want to go through BCCI, but the Promise Software story fits in here very deeply.
So one thing, before we get to Promise, about the 1980s, one of the reasons too is the deregulation of the savings and loans industry, which is you know, a big part of what happens in that particular era.
Right.
And then Promise is basically used to tap and track money and hide money all over the world, and enables money laundering on a scale never before dreamed possible.
Right.
And when a lot of people talk about the Promise software, they leave the whole financial side out of it completely and treat it as something that was used to place backdoors exclusively into security and intelligence agencies of different countries around the world. And it was actually both. You know, Israel led on the effort to backdoor intelligence agencies around the world, and their main salesman for that was Robert Maxwell, Ghislaine Maxwell's father. But beyond that, you also had an effort that was involved with U.S. intelligence, organized crime, and drug cartels in Mexico mainly, and also Colombia, that are all coming together to create another version of Promise that was marketed by different companies, but mainly Systematics, which is tied up with the whole Clinton nexus of power. And that was used to basically backdoor the global financial system. And this particular network backdoors the financial system around the world, including central banks like China's central bank, and basically penetrating financial systems previously closed to them by, you know, marketing particular software that, you know, the recipients don't necessarily know is backdoored, but it is. And then it, you know, enables them to mess around with whatever system it's installed on, essentially, and observe what people are doing using that system in real time without them knowing.
So, you know, I have a book that I published online. I've never published it in hard copy. But I got a cartoon from the New Yorker, and it's a Viking with one of those big hats sitting behind a desk. And there's a picture of a huge Viking ship, and he's saying to somebody, we only pillage and rape electronically now.
Yeah.
And it's on the section about...
That's the world today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But what is amazing is Promise has had such a remarkable effect, and very few people understand or know the story. And I think that's another reason that your book is special, because it ties it in with a lot of these other threads.
Right. Well, I don't even think the story's been fully told, really, by anyone. And, you know, I devote a whole chapter to Promise in the book, and it pops up in other parts as well. And I tried to bring up some different aspects of it, but what's problematic to me, in my opinion, is that, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of people act like the Israeli backdoor and the CIA organized crime backdoor were separate, but they were actually collaborative.
Right.
And for example, the Systematics Promise software stuff, Robert Maxwell collaborated with them, selling that to Swiss banks, right? And in the sale of Promise to banks, you have people that were on Israeli intelligence payroll, and also all sorts of other intelligence payrolls, like Adnan Khashoggi. And key figures in the Iran-Contra scandal are involved in selling this stuff to banks that were, you know, sister banks of BCCI and stuff, you know, in the Middle East. And, you know, I mean, it's just really there's a lot of different aspects of promise that sort of just get omitted from most versions of it. And, you know, they're either focusing on the CIA one only or the Israeli one only. And a lot of people don't look at them together. And it was obviously collaborative. And even people that were involved, you know, in promise or in the effort to, you know, steal and backdoor promise have told me when I was doing interviews for the book that yes, it was collaborative. It was never like a competitive thing, and a lot of authors have painted it as such.
Mm-hmm. One of the most important threads to understand Epstein is the Clintons and the rise of the Clintons and their association with Epstein, which was, to me, was, you know, as intimate as it gets. And you document that out by going through sort of, you know, Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton rose on organized crime in Arkansas, but organized crime that was very, you know, an integral part of intelligence operations. So I keep thinking about, I don't know if you ever read the book Boys on the Track about Linda Ives' story, but Linda Ives was a mother whose son was killed by...
His son was killed in Arkansas,
yeah. And she was just trying to figure out what was going on, you know, what had happened to her son. And the next thing she knows, she's got black helicopters down on her head and the whole national security state. And she can't understand, how do I, as a little housewife in Arkansas, draw in this kind of firepower?
And asking the wrong questions.
Right. Right. And anyway, but the Arkansas was a, you know, at the time was a relatively small state, but it drew together the national security state, the intelligence agencies, the organized crime. The, I mean, it's an incredible nexus, and it's an incredible story to understand sort of the history that created Epstein.
Yeah, and it's very complex. So I'm not sure exactly which aspects you want to get into. So I guess I'll give a summary of the different networks there. But organized crime always, pretty much always, had a presence in Arkansas at some point.
Right.
And I note this in the book. And Clinton's, Bill Clinton's uncle had some sort of ties with organized crime that helped launch his early political career. And then Clinton, at a very early age, particularly when he was studying abroad at Oxford, developed a relationship with intelligence. And, you know, these sorts of networks mixed around Clinton really ever since, to be honest. And so eventually you have people bankrolling him like Jackson Stevens.
Right.
And also Jackson Stevens' business partners, the Riady family, who were based in Indonesia. Right. And, you know, they're intimately involved with, you know, efforts to bring BCCI into the U.S. financial system. Right. Jackson Stevens controls Systematics, which is marketing promise to banks. And they take over, you know, Riady and Stevens take over significant financial institutions based in Macau. It's Chinese now, but used to be a Portuguese enclave in China.
Right.
That's described as the Las Vegas of the East. So, you know, money laundering, casinos, sex trafficking, all of that stuff goes on in Macau in a big way, and has been used by the power elite of China for those things, because it was sort of like an unregulated environment, very close and basically within China. And now, you know, of course, it's since 1999, I believed, you know, part of China now. So, you know, it's definitely a complex situation there. But the banks they took over in particular were involved with like the illicit gold trade, money laundering, all types of stuff. And so their tendrils, you know, this union between them extends far beyond Arkansas, but Arkansas becomes a major hub for it in a huge way. And Jackson Stevens' business empire based in Arkansas becomes flush with taxpayer money when Clinton is governor through all these different finance authorities that Clinton basically redevelops. And then basically, you know, you'll find Stevens Inc., his flagship company, and all sorts of other Stevens-connected enterprises basically engaged in cronyism on an incredible scale.
Right. It was really interesting when Lloyd Blankfein, the chairman of Goldman Sachs, was being grilled during the financial crisis for so-called corrupt behavior by Goldman Sachs. The representative from Arkansas gave him a little speech about how important it was to have high integrity like Jackson Stevens. And Blackfine is trying to keep a straight face, and he's really struggling. It's an amazing, his eyes almost pop out, but he manages to do it. And I thought, well, that's why he gets paid the big bucks.
Yeah. To keep his mouth shut.
Right. He did a great job.
Yeah.
So I was in Washington during the period when they transitioned from Bush to Clinton's, and the Bushies were very they had a lot of protocol about the illegal stuff is over here and we keep that separate, and here's the legal stuff, and we have a very they had two parallel universes and they tried to keep them separate. The Clintons got to town and they were like, oh, well, that's all too hard. It's just one big happy family. No pretense. It's just rock and roll. And everything was out of the closet. And it was a remarkable cultural shift. And, Clinton was just very, this is how the world works. Get over it. Get used to it. They.
Well, in Arkansas, what he was able to get away with in Arkansas, I think just made them feel like,
Right.
yeah, try and do something to us. And I mean, basically it worked. I mean, sure, you had investigations into Whitewater and, you had Ken Starr there and all of this, but I mean, he didn't get to the bottom of anything because obviously he didn't want to get to the bottom of an awful lot. And even congressional investigations into Clinton era scandals, they'll mention things and they like act like it's just a little quirk or something of the people they're talking about, and it's like it's obviously evidence of like insane major criminal activity, and they have no interest in pursuing that lead.
Well, my favorite one was during the impeachment, it sort of reached an apex, and then Clinton put out volume one of the Inspector General report on the drug dealing into South Central LA, the so-called Dark Alliance allegations. So they say they're going to move forward with impeachment. That day, he puts out volume one on the CIA website, and then the next day, all the Republicans come out and say, well, they're going to go through the process, but the president won't be impeached. And my interpretation of what he did was he said, you take me down, I'll take down everybody.
Well, I don't think it's just that, though, because I think that also a lot of the Clinton era scandals involved some of the same networks that
Absolutely.
were utilized for illegal activity under Bush and Reagan.
Right.
And so
The
that's why you
Republican
see.
The Republicans were much more compromised by the Dark Alliance allegations than the Democrats. Yeah. So I think the
Yeah,
Republicans
absolutely.
backed off because they couldn't, they were up into it in their eyeballs. The one thing I wanted to mention too is you get into it's a chapter called The Dark Secrets of the Reagan Administration, and you get into sort of the pedophilia, some of the pedophilia scandals that happened, which I think had a major role in building the control files in Washington. So I think the 80s, both in terms of explosion of financial fraud and explosion of building control files using sex, really ramped up the game, and that was the platform that Epstein walked in on.
Yeah, so basically in the 1980s, you have that type of activity in Washington for the purpose of blackmail really explode
Right.
in a huge way. But it was going on well before the Watergate era, for example, and really even before then, the McCarthy era as well. You also have sexual blackmail really going on under the surface
Right.
in a big way in all these different kinds of power politics.
One of the great lines from you was, I think you gave this in an interview, is Epstein was not an anomaly.
No, not at all.
Right.
Really, and I think that's why so many people in the elite, even after he was outed for what he was doing, were so comfortable associating with him because so many people have done this
Right.
historically in the US. Epstein's the only one that's really just been caught, but I think personally that he was allowed to be caught. Something had happened and, he had to be he became inconvenient for these people, and it was easier for them to try and do a limited hangout takedown.
Right.
Of Epstein, and that's why the focus is only on, 2000 to 2006, roughly, sex crimes only on Epstein. They don't talk about anything else in his career, in mainstream media. But really quick, in the 1980s, you have 1982, a Page Boy scandal. The Page Boy scandal breaks. That's largely forgotten. It was centered around Larry Craig, who years later, in 2007, basically is outed, for engaging in that exact type of activity. And it was covered up in the 1980s, and the person who accused Craig was basically forced to recant after all sorts of things happened. But the person they focused on was Robert Keith Gray, who is a key figure in volume one of the book.
Right.
nominally a PR executive, but a lot of military connections, a lot of intelligence connections, and a lot of involvement with sexual blackmail going back way before 1982. But he was a key part of the Reagan campaign in 1980 that was run basically by Bill Casey, who of course becomes CIA director when Reagan takes office in 1981. And people that worked directly with Robert Keith Gray, like Roy Cohn on that campaign, also heavily involved in sex blackmail through the same period of time. And that same year, 1982, Robert Keith Gray, Roy Cohn, and Jeffrey Epstein all take on Adnan Khashoggi as a client, which I think is very interesting because that's right when Adnan Khashoggi is getting basically setting up what later becomes known as, you know, the Iran-Contra arms for hostages stuff. Right. All at the same time, it's very interesting, especially when you consider that Casey, why he was running the Reagan campaign and before he became CIA director was the chief legal counsel for Bear Stearns, where Epstein was working at the time. So, you have, you know, that network already involved in the Page Boy scandal, the early 80s, and why this is going on, too. You have the rise of a man named Larry King, and also the rise of a man named Craig Spence. And Craig Spence and Larry King were basically in business together. Larry King based in Nebraska, Omaha, where Robert Key Graith is also from. And it's between there, really, and D.C., at least as far as we know. It seems to have been nationwide on a massive scale. Right. From what has been reported, but in terms of most of the evidence, it seems focused on Nebraska and then Washington, D.C. Right. And Craig Spence was really the most involved in D.C. And he was a very close personal friend of Roy Cohn, hosted his birthday party at his home. And just like Roy Cohn, managed sexual blackmail operations and boasted about having intelligence ties, he dies of a suspicious suicide as well after he gets essentially outed for his role in all of this. And Larry King, you know, also gets covered up. Right. And apparently runs a used car dealership today and is still around. But allegedly, you know, the person that was allowing them to take underage boys into the White House, they're called call boys in the Washington Times articles about it, was Donald Gregg, who is an intelligence guy very close to George Bush Sr., who was his national security advisor, I believe, while he was vice president during this period. And is, you know, it definitely went very high up, the Franklin scandal. And it wasn't the only sex trafficking or pedophilia linked scandal in this particular network. You have the Covenant House stuff happening too, which I also talk about in the book, which involves one of the main financiers behind Bush. I forget his first name, but the last name is like McCulley. And they're involved with Americares. They have a relationship with Southern Air Transport, the Iran-Contra drug weapon trafficking airline that's basically run by the CIA. And of course, that airline is basically taken over by Leslie Wexner and Jeffrey Epstein in 1995 when this particular group finishes with it. And so they're clearly adapting it for the Clinton era. And so as I note in the book, I think it's very likely that move of Southern Air Transport is directly linked to Epstein's visits to the White House in that same exact period.
So that's exactly where I want to go, because that really starts Volume 2, Chapter 11, The Rise of Jeffrey Epstein. So I want to step back and walk away from the book for a second and bring up a very important date. In September 1994, the Federal Reserve System did something that they had not done for decades, and that was they bought shares in the Bank of International Settlements. And with the Bank of International Settlements, they built a system over the next couple decades that would allow systemically important institutions, banks and financial institutions, to have sovereign immunity for a whole bunch of different activities. But it also created a form of money laundering pipes that would allow them to move money from U.S. Treasury accounts, the New York Fed is the depository, into BIS accounts and move trillions anywhere in the world. Totally behind sovereign immunity, totally secret. It's a whole new avenue for money movement. So that happens in September 1994, And the leadership doing that is essentially Greenspan and Rubin. Rubin at Treasury and in the administration, and Greenspan. Now, if I remember correctly from volume two, Rubin is the guy who first walks Epstein over into the White House, isn't he?
He is. He is. Yeah. But at the time, he wasn't a Treasury Secretary. He was, I believe, head of the National Economic Council.
Right. And then now remember, before he did that, he came from Harvard. And of course, Harvard Corporation is a huge player in all of these different events. But
yeah.
But
and I would point out with Rubin that before Clinton came into office, he was, running Goldman Sachs, basically. Right. And in that same exact period of time is when Goldman Sachs was under fire for their role in Robert Maxwell's financial crimes.
And their role at MENA, Arkansas with
all other thing. Yeah.
Because if you look at the housing agency and some of the bonding agencies, Goldman Sachs was up to their eyeballs in the agencies that were supposedly using those bond deals to launder some of the money. So Goldman Sachs was deep in all different aspects of this story, and Harvard. So, okay. So 94, Epstein goes to the White House for the first time, and you have a series of 93. You have a series of meetings between Clinton, Epstein. He's at the White House. Clinton leaves the administration, and it's almost like the next day he and Epstein start flying around together.
Yeah. And that's because Epstein's basically setting up the Clinton Foundation.
Right.
So I probably have to give some background here about the Epstein-Clinton relationship, because there is a very specific reason that, despite the fact that we now have photographic evidence of Epstein and Clinton shaking hands and meeting each other in 1993, the mainstream media in the U.S. still acts like they didn't meet until Clinton left office. And even though the visitor logs have come out and what was previously thought to be only roughly five meetings between Epstein and Mark Middleton grew to 17 in less than a two-year span. And he's not just meeting with Middleton. He's meeting with people like Robert Rubin. And there's pictures of him attending a function where he's, photographed, he and Ghislaine Maxwell shaking, Bill Clinton's hand and engaging in a meet and greet, obviously very inconvenient to the narrative. And then you have it come out that one of Clinton's top donors, Lynn Forrester de Rothschild, writes a letter to Clinton saying, "I only had 15 minutes to talk to you when I saw you the other day, and I got to talk to you about the two things at the top of my list: Jeffrey Epstein and currency stabilization." So Epstein, Clinton could not have not known,
right.
About Epstein until he leaves office. And the fact that the American mainstream media, despite all the attention that Epstein receives, including the Epstein-Clinton relationship, that only the UK's Daily Mail is the only English language outlet in the mainstream to cover that is astounding to me.
It is astounding.
And it tells you really everything you need to know. Because when you start to look at the Clinton-Epstein relationship, what we know of it, in the 1990s, it's very clear that Epstein was probably the top enabler of Clinton-era financial crimes. And I say this because after that meeting with Robert Rubin in 1993, his next involvement is with this fundraiser that Hillary Clinton is ostensibly running that's involving the White House Historical Association. It's supposed to be about refurbishing the White House. But Epstein, Epstein isn't the only donor, but other donors include people like Clark Clifford, who's intimately involved with BCCI, for example, and a guy named C. Gerald Goldsmith, who's this really shady Palm Beach banker who runs involved with a very shady bank in Palm Beach, where Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell both have accounts.
Right.
And he's, involved with Bahamas offshore organized crime networks and all of this stuff.
Right.
These are the people that are donating to Hillary Clinton's, changing of draperies, supposedly, at the White House. And this particular fundraiser is significant is because it is actually mentioned in Vince Foster's quote-unquote suicide note. And Vince Foster was the counsel to the White House. And New York Times reporting from the time notes that he would have been the person who would have decided whether there was anything suspect or not about the financing of that donation. So that suicide note, widely known pretty for anyone, that isn't going to shill for these people, to be a forgery, because it wasn't there in his office when he was found dead, and it magically appears like 36 hours later, and it was all Hillary Clinton orchestrating it. This is all mainstream reporting,
right?
You know, about those events from the time, okay? And the only mention of Hillary Clinton in that suicide note, which, you know, if we know Foster didn't write it,
right,
and Clinton had a role in handling it, it's obviously going to be taking the, you know, absolving herself of something bad that she did. You know, I think that's pretty clear that the only reason she'd be mentioned in there, and it's specifically about this fundraiser. It's about you know, oh, HRC did nothing wrong. Hillary Rodham Clinton, HRC did nothing wrong about this fundraiser. Why is that in there? And then you know, Clark Clifford, Epstein, and this Goldsmith guy, it's like, yeah, okay, something else was going on here for that to end up in, you know, Vince Foster's suicide note.
So let me bring up a couple of dates. October 1, 1997 is when the $21 trillion started to blow out of the U.S. government. And the question I've always had is, okay, who laundered it? How did it get laundered? Where did it go? Then in 1998, 99, you have Glass-Steagall come down, and the financial fraud just explodes to a whole new level.
And that's Summers, Epstein, and Epstein crony already by that point.
And at the same time, you have the housing fraud explode into the housing bubble, or it starts. Mm-hmm. I mean, it had been building 94. What's interesting is it started to build exactly in the 93, 94 area, and they got all the conditions precedent. But then the volume really starts to explode 97, 98. So all these things are happening together. And there is a literally hundreds of billions of dollars disappearing. And the question is, okay, how did it get laundered? Where did it go? And it's one of the many reasons I've been interested in Epstein, because Epstein, Clinton leaves the White House. And what's the date he leaves the White House? January 2000?
I believe the 2000 election, right? Bush wins, so he would have taken office January 2001.
So Clinton leaves January 2001 and gets in a plane with Epstein, and Gates shows up there too, somewhere in here, right?
Officially, the Epstein-Gates relationship didn't happen until 2011, but that's a lie. We know that they had a relationship in the 1990s, and I try and demystify it in the book. And I on my website, I do have an article already published with most of that research out, so it's publicly available. What's happening there with Epstein and Gates is Epstein setting up the Clinton Foundation, and specifically things like the Clinton Global Initiative and the healthcare initiatives of the Clinton Foundation.
Right.
And around the same time, the person who was previously Epstein's science advisor, who was basically a woman that he groomed, not for sex traffic. Well, she was involved in sex blackmail, I believe, as well. But I don't know how in depth I want to get on that. But basically, the sex trafficking operation of Epstein had two distinct tiers. You have women who were intelligent and cultivated to be like the wives and girlfriends of the elite,
right?
And then you have the ones that were exploited, that Ghislaine Maxwell called trash, that were used for the massages and just you know, treated as very expendable. But there's a class of women that are also brought in this same way, and they're not treated that way. A lot of those women accompanied Epstein on his White House visits, most of them.
Right.
Which, you know, amazing that it hasn't gotten any mainstream coverage, because that's really scandalous. But anyway, this woman is Melanie Walker. She, in 1992, Epstein recruited her to be a Victoria's Secret model. There's no evidence she ever modeled for Victoria's Secret. He seems to have subsidized her graduate studies, and then she becomes his science advisor in 1999. And then does a stint, I think, at the World Health Organization in China, and then gets hired by the Gates Foundation. That's where a lot of the Epstein-Gates connections come in. And it's very obvious that Epstein and Gates knew each other before 2011, because imagine being Bill Gates. You're going to hire your top science advisor. They come in for an interview. Their resume is, I was science advisor to Jeffrey Epstein.
Right.
You have to know who Jeffrey Epstein was, and you have to know what kind of science he was into.
So
you're not just going to be like, oh, okay, take the job. You know, that's not how Bill Gates obviously operates. So there's more to the story.
So Clinton and Epstein start running around the world doing deals. Yeah.
They're mainly going to Africa and they're mainly going to Asia. To
Right.
understand the Asia trip, you have to understand why the scandal that was going on around Mark Middleton at the Clinton White House, because most of Epstein's visits to the Clinton White House were with Mark Middleton.
Right.
And Mark Middleton intimately involved in what is, I think, erroneously called Chinagate. It's really more accurately called Riotigate, I think,
Right.
for the Riotti family. And, you know, this really shady stuff that's going on, particularly with arms trafficking, I believe, but
Right.
also basically buying influence with the Clinton administration that's used to enable illegal weapons smuggling into the United States and the illegal smuggling of high technology out of the United States to China and the Soviet
Right.
Union or former Soviet Union, which is an insane scandal in itself, that was totally memory holed. And it was actually Bush, George W. Bush, that stepped in to cover that up.
Right. And
So I think the Epstein Asia trip with Clinton is related to that stuff because they're hitting basically all the same countries where Middleton was operating too, after he leaves the White House. And the ones that loom large in that scandal, it's China, it's Taiwan, it's Singapore, and it's Indonesia, because of the Riadis, obviously. So, but with the Africa stuff, it's setting up the HIV/AIDS initiatives of
Right.
Clinton. And Clinton credits Epstein with having developed that. And then, of course, from a very early stage, the Clinton Foundation and the Gates Foundation set up just, you know, within months of each other, cooperate on those initiatives.
Right.
And, you know, Clinton admitted at the time that Epstein designed them. And then in 2012, an official testimony he gives to a court in the Virgin Islands, Epstein says, "I do a lot of work in Africa and it's the perfect place to experiment." And Epstein had no official presence in Africa.
Right.
So I think he was involved at that late of a stage, still with the Clinton and Gates Foundation in their Africa AIDS stuff. So
Right.
that's very disturbing that he's basically the architect of that when you consider that, as now acknowledged by the New York Times, The Guardian, and several other mainstream media outlets, he was a transhumanist and he was a eugenicist.
Right. So I think one of the reasons that you've seen such an extraordinary cover-up of what Epstein was really up to is because you can't look at Epstein without unpacking what the Clinton Foundation was really up to, and you probably can't do it without understanding some of what the Gates Foundation was up to, and that's what they don't want unpacked because and I'll take it one step further. You know, if you follow back where all that money is coming from, that's another thing they don't want unpacked.
Well, here's the thing. I ended up being too long-winded to explain it shortly, but basically the Epstein-Clinton relationship goes like this. Epstein, between 1987 and 1993, is involved in one of the largest Ponzi schemes in U.S. history. He's the supposed mastermind of it.
Right.
He's named in during grand jury hearings as the mastermind of it, but his name disappears from the case. And that same year, his name disappears from the case. He's meeting at the White House, involved in this suspect donor reception that ends up in Vince Foster's suicide note.
Right.
After that, he's meeting with Mark Middleton all the time. And Mark Middleton's embroiled in what later becomes known as an illegal campaign finance scandal, sometimes referred to as Chinagate. And Epstein is in the middle of that, again, another financial scandal. And then, you know, as soon as Mark Middleton leaves, you know, Epstein stops meeting at the White House. But by then, there's all this Southern Air Transport stuff going on with him. So, you know, obviously he was focusing on something else at that point. But, you know, Clinton leaves office and he's there right away with Epstein, and Epstein is setting up the Clinton Foundation, the top people who are involved in creating the Clinton Health Access Initiative and the Clinton Foundation are on his plane constantly. People like Gayle King, Era Magaziner, Doug Band, and Clinton. And I would say, if you look at that history from Ponzi schemer to Clinton, you know, bundler, funder, involved in Clinton presidential fundraising, and then he goes to set up the Clinton Family Political Slush Fund, the
Right.
Clinton
But
Foundation.
I want to add another component. He's being introduced and supported by the former head of the Harvard Endowment, the former chairman of Goldman Sachs, the National Economic Advisor, and soon to be the Secretary of the Treasury. So this is not something on the margin or the fringe or done quietly. This is coming top down from the most powerful people in the financial system.
Absolutely.
They are supporting a Ponzi schemer, helping the president do whatever he's doing.
Yeah, and the problem is that we don't know the extent of the financial crimes. We just know they were big.
Right.
And that Epstein was in the middle of them. And you know, like we said earlier, Epstein was a financial criminal that dabbled in sex trafficking. There's a reason the focus is only on sex trafficking and
Right.
only on sex trafficking in a very narrow
Well, but
window. They don't want you looking at Epstein beyond those, you know, 6 years.
what we do know is that by December, by September 10th, 2001, $4 trillion had gone missing from DOD and HUD. We do know that. That's a fact. So, I mean, it's fair to say as you go through your book, Whitney, you watch this organized crime network grow and grow and grow and blossom and grow and grow. And what you know, when I say the trance comes off because you realize by the 90s, this thing is exploding.
It's too way too big to fail by the 90s.
Right.
And a big part of this, I think, is what we sort of touched on a little bit earlier, but didn't really get into, which is the savings and loans crisis.
Right.
You know, that was basically $6 billion in like
Right.
1980s money. That's an enormous sum
Right.
taken out of the savings and loans, and it was basically used to allow allies and people within this particular criminal syndicate to take over corporate America. It basically fueled a lot of the corporate raiders
Right.
to go and just take over everything.
Right.
And so you have these people in bed with intelligence. They're blackmailing Congress, or they're installing their people in Congress, and now they've taken over corporate America, which, you know, there's corporate capture of politicians and all of this. I mean, they're basically running the show in a big way by the times the savings and loans crisis, you
Right.
know,
And
erupts.
one of the advantages of getting governments and corporations dependent on debt and highly leveraged is that there's a lot of disclosure around who owns the stock or who owns the company, but not around who owns and controls the debt.
That's very true.
Yeah, and that's part of the vehicle they use to do this takeover. Now, I started with one of my favorite parts is how you open the book. One of my favorite parts is how you close the book. And that
Good.
was, you know, because clearly Epstein had become expendable. And I think part of the reason was if you look at the technology they had created, whether to do money laundering or the sex or the surveillance, they were moving into a whole new big tech game. And so describe the name of your last chapter and what the last chapter goes into.
Okay, so the last chapter is titled, well, I think it's a little longer than this, but it's basically From Promise to Palantir. And I'm basically trying to explain, since I explained Promise earlier in the book, how we end up with Palantir today. It's basically the same thing and what it means. So Promise was involved, you know, and it was stolen from a company called Insla Inc. So that resulted in a very protracted legal battle. And eventually the government's argument became the version of Promise we stole and the version of Promise we're using have become so different because we've modified it so much that it's no longer the product we stole, and therefore, you know, we're not, you know, you can't sue us for theft because we're not using the stolen software anymore,
Right.
was basically what they were saying. And so because of that argument and this legal battle that they were in that actually involved, you know, it was sort of a tug of, there were people on the side of Insla Inc. that were very influential in Washington at the time. So it was tricky for them. And you had congressmen backing Insla Inc. and stuff, particularly in after the death of the journalist Danny Casalero in 1991. And in some other events. But basically what the government decided to do, and I point this out in the book, is that, you know, because that's their argument, they need to basically develop a software that does exactly what Promise does, or what they modified Promise to do by that point, but have it basically packaged and resold as having come from a company that has literally nothing to do with Insla Inc. And so this company that is chosen to do this is co-founded by three people. Two of them are very important because one of them is the daughter of Robert Maxwell, who was the salesman of the, you know, the bugged promise software, and the sister of Ghislaine Maxwell, Christine Maxwell. And the other co-founder is a man named Alan Wade, who at the time was one of the top officers at the CIA, and shortly thereafter becomes chief information officer of the CIA. Right after 9/11, well, I think also before, Alan Wade was cooperating with John Poindexter, who was one of the most prominent Iran-Contra criminals, who's also pardoned in 1991 by CIA cover-up man William Barr, masquerading as an attorney general. they're working together on something that is pitched as TIA, Total Information Awareness, which is operating within DARPA, which is basically a massive surveillance system that's basically a pre-crime system, but it's being pitched as the only way to stop terrorism after 9/11. And I point out in the book that the arguments for TIA mm-hmm. and Palantir as it exists today are exactly the same.
Right.
And Alan Wade is the person... I'm getting ahead of myself. So anyway, Total Information Awareness was very controversial. Even within the mainstream press at the time, they said it would eliminate privacy and just totally stomp all over our constitutional rights. And they were correct. It totally was going to do that. But the concern they realized was that the TIA involved the military. It was a public-private partnership.
Right, so subject to FOIA. Right.
Yeah, so instead they just took it private.
Right.
And the person that took it private is Peter Thiel.
Right.
And Peter Thiel is not a good guy, and he is one of the biggest funders of independent media today, particularly on the right, and also one of the money men behind Rumble, the YouTube competitor. So keep all of that in mind while right. I'm telling you about Palantir now, because it was literally designed to be TIA privatized. When Peter Thiel and Alex Karp, who's CEO of Palantir today, were setting up Palantir, they got the person showing them around Washington was Richard Perle, the neocon guy from Reagan in the Bush era, who, as I note in the book, tied up with Wexner, tied up with Israeli intelligence, and very open to selling out U.S. national security whenever it suits him, among other things. Very unpleasant human being. So Richard Perle connects them with John Poindexter, and this is in mainstream media, yeah. John Poindexter is like, yeah, I talked to them because they were basically trying to recreate TIA, Total Information Awareness. So that's what Palantir became. And so Palantir was funded initially by Peter Thiel and NQTEL, which is the CIA's venture capital arm. Alan Wade of Kiliad, which at this point was being phased out as national security software and being repackaged to be healthcare software. At the same time, by the way, that Epstein was pivoting into healthcare as well, uh-huh. and all this futuristic medicine, something to keep in mind. You have Alan Wade advising Palantir on behalf of NQTEL, because basically NQTEL, they claim to be independent from the CIA, but they're not. They make investments in companies, right. and then the CIA comes in and helps them tailor the products to meet the CIA's needs. Right. And Alex Karp has admitted that Palantir's intended client from the very beginning was the CIA.
Right.
And so the CIA was their only client for the first 3 years.
What were those years, Palantir Whitney,
programmers,
again?
Huh?
What were those years again, those 3 years?
2005 to 2008,
okay.
I believe.
2005 to
yeah.
2008.
And after that point, you know, Palantir obviously gets a lot bigger. And today they're used by every single intelligence agency. I think we're up to 18 now with Space Force. So, you know, Palantir's everywhere. I mean, also the FBI uses it. I mean, everything pretty much.
The IRS entered into a contract with them in 2018. I don't know if it's still existing.
Well, it would make sense. Basically, though, Palantir does what Promise does. It links all these different databases together and makes them searchable.
Right.
And the New York Times a couple of years ago did a puff piece on it, and they called it the all-seeing eye.
Right.
At the very top. And that's basically how they view it. And if you look at the old logo for Total Information Awareness, it was literally a pyramid with the all-seeing eye right. covering the entire right. planet Earth. It sounds like a joke, but that's literally what the logo was. So Palantir literally does exactly that. And it is, mining your data from social media all the time.
Right.
And everything you do online, Palantir takes in and they catalog you. And one of the things they can tag you as on behalf of the CIA is as a subversive. And as I note in the book, going back to the original theft of promise, it was being used by people like Poindexter and Oliver North to create a list of dissidents in the United States.
Right.
And that database is called Maine Corps, and it still exists today.
Right.
And the last time it was reported on by the mainstream, it was in 2008. And at that point, it had 6 million Americans. It probably has a lot more now. And as we're getting into Biden's war on domestic terror, where he is now called about roughly half the country terror threats, you can bet that it's going to be Palantir deciding who's a terrorist and who's not. And that's why it's very relevant that the guy funding, a lot of the platforms used by these terror threat MAGA Republicans, as Biden calls them, is the guy that created this system.
Right. So I used to call Maine Corps the data beast. So now the database.
It is the database, though. I mean, everything the NSA or any other intelligence agency has sucked up on you.
Right.
Your name and Maine Corps.
Not the database, the data beast.
Oh, data beast.
The data beast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is that.
Right.
Really.
Right.
Yeah, it's not nice at all. I mean, in the 1980s, they wanted to use that database to round up Americans they thought might, protest an illegal invasion of Nicaragua when they were supporting the Contras.
Right.
If they decided to illegally invade.
So remember the brouhaha about the 87,000 IRS agents?
Yeah.
At the time, Yellen came out and made it very clear that a lot of the money was not going to be spent on more agents. It was going to be spent on high-tech systems like this. What I heard was...
And those systems are there. Right. Your banking records and financial history is all in Maine Corps.
All in Maine Corps, yes.
It's all there.
Everything. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the book is finished. You're going to be... A lot of people are going to want to talk about this book for a while, but what's next for Whitney Webb?
Well, I'm currently working on a series dismantling the idea that the SDGs or the UN Sustainable Development Goals are actually sustainable development as most people think of it, because the only thing they're really sustaining is the power of the financial elite and, right. neo-feudalism.
You just put up a new article and it was republished in The Defender. It's up at Unlimited Hangout, your website, correct?
Yeah, it's called Sustainable Debt Slavery. So that's the first installment. Uh-huh. That's basically the introduction to the SDGs, where the World Bank and the IMF are basically admitting that now every time a developing world country has a problem with debt, they're going to force them to implement SDGs. And some of these include things like debt for conservation swaps or debt for climate swaps. But this is really an old agenda that...
Right.
Years and years and years precedes the SDGs. Or Agenda 2030, they're essentially the same thing. They used to be called debt for land swaps, but now they're debt for climate swaps, debt for conservation swaps.
So what you're talking about is putting people in a debt trap and then squeezing out their assets.
Yeah, well, it's sort of like how the IMF before would be like, okay, we'll give you this loan or we'll let you restructure your debt, but you have to impose these policies.
Right.
And those policies would be like remove these regulatory barriers or do this.
Or sell these assets.
Austerity.
Yeah, sell these assets for cheap to the following companies.
Which are almost always foreign and stuff like that. Yeah, so
and
that is now moving to impose things like, ESG or net zero and all of this stuff.
Right.
And it's basically the same game as before, but with a different end goal of basically creating the infrastructure for this totalitarian technocratic slavery system.
Right.
But using debt as the main weapon to do that. And they admit it. So, this first installment is about you know, that system in general, and then after is going to come a deep dive on different SDGs and how they basically fit that model. So the ones we have in the works now are the one on the SDG about healthcare, and then the SDG about ocean conservation, and we hope to add more.
Right.
You know, but I also need to take a break at some point because that book was a lot of work. And if I can really quickly talk, I got off topic telling the Palantir story. Well, not off topic, but I didn't bring it back to Epstein at the end, right? So I just wanted to add that Palantir, the way it is now, you don't need someone that does sex blackmail anymore, like Epstein was doing. And you don't need a financial criminal whiz like him anymore to pull off mass fraud either. Because of the advances in technology and how ubiquitous technology has become in our lives and all of that stuff, you know, it's much easier to just manipulate the software than manipulate the people or pay for an asset, which also doesn't include just like maintaining like Epstein's mansions and all of this stuff, or like, you know, the expenses of, you know, the women they're paying off or exploiting or whatever, but also, you know, bribery of law enforcement and things like that.
Be much more centralized and much quieter.
Yeah, and so basically, you know, your digital footprint now has basically not just made it easier for them to blackmail you, but now everyone is blackmailable in a way like never before. But as I point out in the book, you know, it's much easier to unplug this system because they're assuming that we'll never
unplug.
You know, leave the convenience of technology behind. Yeah, so
use cash.
Yeah.
Use cash. So let me ask you, one of the things that most baffled me that I've never been able to figure out was why in the world did Epstein fly back into the United States? I could have told him not to do that.
You mean his first arrest?
No, the last arrest.
So I have a theory about the last arrest, and I don't have all the answers, but I think I might know why. And it has to do with Saudi Arabia. It has to do with Mohammed bin Salman. Mm-hmm. So you may have heard in mainstream media reports about how Epstein had all these pictures of him and Mohammed bin Salman together in his mansion.
Right.
And so the other people that were photographed with him frequently seen in his mansions, it was him and Bill Clinton and people we like know about, right? But no one's really looked into the Epstein-MBS relationship. And I think Epstein was really the brains behind Mohammed bin Salman's Vision 2030, for example. And one of the things Mohammed bin Salman did after he launches Vision 2030 is give citizenship to Sophia the robot.
Right.
And Sophia the robot was created by a science that was bankrolled by Epstein, named Ben Goertzel.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think, and Epstein was really into transhumanism and all of this stuff. It makes sense. And also, obviously, the installment of MBS and power was part of an intelligence factional battle, obviously, because the guy he deposed was very close to the CIA's John Brennan.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of controversy within, you know, the Brennan faction, if you want to call it that, about MBS's rise to power, because MBS's rise to power involved house arrest of a lot of people that had very close relationships with U.S. intelligence. It was controversial, obviously. And there's a reason why MBS has an initial charm offensive where he's being, the praises of him as a liberator and revolutionary are being sung in the New York Times. Then all of a sudden, the very suspect events of the Jamal Khashoggi murder take place, and then all of a sudden he's persona non grata. So and this is taking place, you know, people that were close to MBS too, you have like Jared Kushner, the guy behind WeWork, who's an Israeli citizen, and all of these people floating around. You have the Israeli intelligence linked Epstein also in the mix. And so I think one of the reasons Epstein was allowed to be taken down is probably related to some of these power plays going on in the Middle East at the time that he was obviously involved in. And another thing he was involved in that particular period is stuff going on with Elon Musk, that I don't really understand how that may have factored in, but it's something to consider too, that Epstein by that point was trying to get rebrand as a Silicon Valley investor, like a tech investor.
Mm-hmm.
And he was advising Elon Musk companies, and he had some weird relationship with Kimball Musk. And it seems like he's sort of entrapped and may have sex blackmailed Kimball Musk, who has a position on the board of several Elon Musk companies, obviously, because they're related. Basically, a woman that was trafficked by Epstein in this sort of like elite tier that I mentioned earlier was set up as Kimball Musk's girlfriend for a period of time, and Epstein was given a tour of SpaceX facilities and stuff like that. So, and I also note in the book that there's some weird connections between other companies tied up with the Elon Musk business universe that tie back to Epstein's sort of offshore vehicles and stuff like that. So there's definitely some weird stuff going on there. And you
Right.
see people like Elon Musk sort of posing as anti-establishment online and stuff. And you have MBS sort of in the Trump sphere, you know. So it seems like we can sort of see what sort of faction Epstein was sort of sitting in at that point. And if he was involved with the rise of MBS, he was obviously, you know, not liked by the John Brennan crowd or the Obama crowd or whatever you want to call them. So it may have been related to stuff going on in that period of time. But unfortunately, we don't have enough to go on. There's just, you know, these little blips that pop up on the radar,
Right.
but it's hard to make a full picture out of it. But I would say that we're seeing some sort of factional, you know, war, I guess, going on, and it's hard to know exactly what's happening, but I think Epstein was allowed to be taken down because of it. And I think he, you know, in terms of why he came back to the US then, he was probably not given a choice.
So they were having trouble keeping a lid on a whole bunch of stuff because he's walking around and getting sued. So he gets essentially taken out, and you get the lid back on. Now, the reality is, if you look at what's going on around Trump, so Trump is up to his eyeball with all these networks, starting with Ray Cohn. And what's been very interesting is if you watch the effort to criticize Trump, they are so careful. You know, they keep bringing up the Russians, but they forget to bring up the Russian mafia. They're so careful to stay away from the whole organized crime
Yeah, there's a
story.
reason for that too,
Right.
though, because the Russian organized crime networks that swim around Trump or have swum around Trump in his real estate empire is really more accurately called the Maxwell Mafia.
Right.
But they were business partners of Robert Maxwell. Robert Maxwell was named by like one of the top FBI special agents in New York City as having basically created a
Right.
global criminal enterprise before he died that involved in a huge way Eastern Europe organized crime, Russian organized crime in Israel, even organized crime, the Yakuza in Japan. I mean, it was like a
Right.
multinational coalition of organized crime, and Robert Maxwell is the man that brought them together. And so the Russian mafia connection, it's always people that tie back to Semyon Mogilevich, and the guy that made Mogilevich was Maxwell.
Right. So if you start stirring the pot with 30 to 50 subpoenas or whatever has been put out, you know, but serious litigation, the question is at some point all of this going to leak out or not?
Well, I think at the same time they're planning all this stuff against Trump, they're also planning this war on domestic terror and they're
Right.
planning mass censorship like we've never seen before. So I
Right.
think they're very confident that they'll be able to keep a lid on it by
Okay.
controlling all the information that comes out. And
Well,
criminalizing people that don't believe it. We had DHS's Mayorkas coming out on 9/11 saying the new terror threat are people who don't believe the government narrative.
I don't know,
So
the government narrative is changing every day. I can't believe it if
that
I can't
doesn't
even
matter
figure
though.
out
Don't
what
ask questions. Don't ask questions. It's
Right.
becoming like one of those air, in authoritarian
Right.
regime, really, where like, okay, so most people probably know that like Pravda or whatever doesn't tell the truth and they don't trust the media. But if they're asked on the spot if they believe it, you know, they'll say yes so they don't get dragged away somewhere. You
Right.
know, I mean, that's basically the system they're trying to set up. They don't think they have to be believable. They just need X amount of Americans to believe it. It doesn't even have to be big. They just have to, you know, control the narrative, control the perception that a decent amount of people support them, even if it's not true,
Well,
and use fear to control everybody and technology, and that's their game plan.
but yet you're not afraid and you publish this book.
No, I'm not, because when you're afraid of people, you're giving them power over you.
Right.
So, you can study this stuff and forensically dissect these people, but if you're afraid of them at the end of the day, you can know everything about them, but they're still going to beat you if you're afraid of them.
Right. Well, the great thing about One Nation Under Blackmail is it takes a lot of the mystery away.
That's the whole point, but I think it's really a starting point. I don't think it's the definitive book on all this stuff. I think it's a way to wake people up and show them there's continuity, because people will recognize the crimes of organized crime and intelligence in yesteryear. They'll be like, yeah, okay, the CIA did bad stuff in the 50s and 60s, but you get up to the 80s and 90s and they're like, stop, conspiracy theorist. If you can show the continuity between then and now, yeah, I mean, they're gonna have a hard time saying that to you at this point. So, the idea is that, and to also, I tried to make it detailed enough for people that are like well researched on these issues that they can also find something new, hopefully. I was trying to find the sweet spot there and not have it be like 3,000 pages. So I guess I did that.
So I'm an investment banker, so I have to make a pitch. Whitney's website is Unlimited Hangout. You can subscribe. You can donate. You can. Is there a link to Trying Day to buy the book? Right. Okay, so subscribe, donate, go buy the book. And I always quote Penske when he says, speed costs money, how fast do you want to go? I think the more we put gas in your pocket and the more you just do what you do, the more amazing the world will be. So,
Oh, thanks.
and I should
I
mention.
hope so that I can live up to that. Yeah, but I mean, I just do my best. I'm not in this for the money. It's really all about, I've just always felt really driven to try and expose as much as I can before they pull the plug on the internet, which they're going to try and do at some point. And it's not, this time frame, this window of time isn't going to be open forever. So, I'm just full speed ahead until it happens. And then when it happens, I'll just go garden. It's
Well,
fine
that's
with me.
why everyone get it in hard copy. I think get it in hard copy, and the more hard copies we spread around, the better. Well, Whitney Webb, thank you for joining me today. I really appreciate it. Can I tell the exciting news that I may get to meet you in person soon?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah, so you're coming to Knoxville. So you're.
Yeah, if it works out, I mean, I have some things to juggle because I have to come with the kids and all that stuff. But I will be doing my best to go to the Children's Health Defense conference at the end of October.
So if there's anything I can do to make sure that happens and to support you in any way, even if it means finding babysitters in Tennessee, just let me know and we're happy.
We'll see.
We're happy. We have lots of Solari team coming who have babysitting experience, whatever. But whatever we can do to help make that a reality, we'd be delighted to do it because I can't wait to meet you in person. Wow.
Yeah, well, it's been really surreal for me because I've been doing this work for, I don't know, several years now, and I've never really gotten to meet anyone that I work with. Because I live in Chile, I live in South America, and I have kids, so it hasn't really been that easy to go back and forth. And I haven't been to the US since I really left in like 2014. So it's been a long time coming, I guess, and it's gonna be pretty surreal for me, because also living in Chile, no one knows my work at all. So I like live in this bubble of like no one knows me, and so I'm gonna go to the US and like especially this conference. I mean, I feel like a lot of people might know me, so I'm gonna have to
Whitney, I've got bad news for you.
get
Everybody
used to
knows you. Everybody knows you.
that. Yeah, okay, so I have to prepare myself for that, I guess, because I'm so not used to it really. So I'm looking forward to it. I really hope it works out.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us on the Solari Report.